This is where I go. My name is Randy Bond. I want to welcome you to this session on coming into full-time missions in mid or mid-plus career. The panel has been assembled to try and give you a vision, if you haven't already done it, for how God can lead something like that, and why God might choose to do that and not just put you in missions from day one after your training. So thank you for being here. Help us as a panel to respond to you. You're not too many, so it doesn't matter so much. How many of you are in active part of your career as opposed to retired? Okay, most people, okay. And how many are employed or in academia, and how many are in private? If you're employed or in academia as opposed to private practice, raise your hand. So, and the rest of you are in private practice or just looming out there. Okay. And how many are actively considering a change at this time? Some of you people have already changed. I don't know. Okay. Nice. Great. And how many have been on short-term or up to a year trips abroad? Most of the same people. Excellent. How many of you are not married? Only one. Okay.
No, two.
Two.
Okay. Sorry. Lost behind a head. And how many of you have your youngest child in high school or older? Okay. Cool. All right. And how many of you have aging parents still alive? As to eternally aging parents. Okay, thanks. Just giving us an idea. So I'm going to name the panel, and they can introduce themselves in one or two to say what they did before, and then what they went to do, and what they're doing, and we'll come back, and the size of their family and situation for that, and then we'll come back to how God worked into them doing it. And my name is Randy Bond. And I was an academic physician at University of Virginia and Cincinnati Children's for 28 years. And my wife and I had two children, and we left to work in first Malawi briefly, and then with Surge in Burundi, where within 2 months I was named the dean of the medical school. And that's another story, yes. Sucker is the right word. And did that for 6 years.
I'm Mark Tabazian. Sadly, my wife Janet is not here. She's teaching middle school science in Addis Ababa, where we live. I had a career in academic medicine in the U.S. and left that early to move to Ethiopia about 5 years ago.
Specialty?
Oh, sorry, I'm a gastroenterologist.
And I did PEDS and emergency medicine.
Oh, let's see if we got this one here. I'm Dave Burgess. Is that coming through? I can't tell.
Not yet.
That might not be a bad thing.
Oh, you're talking about the microphone?
Yeah.
I thought you meant. Oh. There's no picture.
This is on, I think, right?
Yeah, no picture.
Yep,
there
it is. Great. I'm Dave Burgess. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. Came out of private practice. I'd been in the military for a period, did private practice for many years, and the Lord unexpectedly called us to long-term missions. And then my wife and I served at the Cure Hospital in Malawi for about 6 years, where I was medical director.
Hi, my name is Bert Lee. My wife and I were with Africa Inland Mission in Kajabi, Kenya. I'm an ICU specialist or intensivist. I left mid-career, I would say, and then we left when our kids were 12 and 15, which I think is the age where they tell you not to do that. But we did. And then we returned when the younger of the two kids started college. And we had to start paying for their college tuition.
I'm going to ask the panel, starting with Mark, and I'll go last. Can you tell me how God moved you from where you were to do something new? What changed? How did you hear that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I look out the audience, I see at least two units in the audience that would talk to this because themselves moved in midlife. To be missionaries, so I'm sure we'll have maybe a broader discussion about this. But for me, my wife and I, in our first year of marriage, had lived in Liberia with we were with SIM at that time. That's considered short-term, being 1 year, but it was sort of missions was in our mind ever after that. And it was really my wife, our three daughters had grown and were in college, and she was like, maybe it's time to move. And my thought was, we'd been going back and forth to Africa for many years in a short-term way, and my thought was, well, we'll just lengthen out those visits and I'll work part-time. And she was like, well, I'm a teacher. No school wants me to visit for 6 weeks. School needs me to be there. So we decided just to move. But for me as a physician, I was very successful at what I did and got a lot of satisfaction from what I did. And I didn't really realize that a lot of my identity was so rooted in my work. I would have told you I'm a Christian and a follower of Jesus and very active in my church. But there were some signs that my identity was really primarily planted in my profession. And I was very fortunate that a young colleague asked me to do a study with him called Sonship, which really exposed to me the fact that that was true about me and that something needed to change. And that actually was key for me in ultimately coming to the point of saying, yeah, we really need to do this, and kind of getting on board with my wife to just move.
I would say we came unexpectedly into missions. We had wanted to do missions very early in our career. After my residency, we served in the Philippines, where my wife had actually grown up on the mission field. And so we went there thinking the Lord was going to call us into missions. And we both felt this distinct call to not do missions, but to support missions for several years, which was quite a shock to us. And so then about 25 years later, as I was in practice, both my wife and I felt very quickly a call to missions. One of the things I was really glad at is that he did that at a time when I don't think we had ever been happier where we lived. We could not have been happier with our situation, with our children, who were away from the home and had been married. I've never been as happy in my professional career, as an orthopedic surgeon. I was in a great practice. And I guess that brings up one of my points, is I think it's really important to leave for the mission field out of a place of loving where you are, and don't leave out of a situation where you're unhappy. So leave out of a situation of happiness and doing the work you're supposed to be doing, and not leave because you're disgruntled somewhere, because that will go along with you. And so the Lord just surprisingly spoke into our lives. And we're not people where we sort of say, oh, the Lord's told me to do X, Y, or Z. But we both felt the strong leading to that, and actually gave our practice 2 years notice to leave our practice, because we were in a bit more of a rural place. It was a little more difficult. So I think it was really important to leave our practice, to leave our patients well, to leave the hospital well. Because we felt like we had spent a lot of time investing in these people, witnessing the people in our community, and we wanted to give them the sense that we were leaving them in a similar way as we had been practicing with them.
Yeah. So in my situation, after I became a believer in college, I went to a missions conference for the first time, and being a young believer, I hadn't heard all these faith stories before. And I had a chance to listen to Elizabeth Elliot at a conference, and I never heard her story. First time hearing it live, and I of course, learned about her and her husband and what happened in Ecuador. And I think you all know that her husband was killed, and then she decided to return to that tribe. And for me, listening as a new believer to that fresh story just really brought me to tears, because I really realized that the gospel is really important. It's that important, and it's that precious. And so so I decided that, I really want to serve God as a missionary. And so that was in college. And then, obviously all the years of medical training, sometimes that sort of sucks all of your joy in life out of it at times. But more importantly for us, we had believing parents who were dead set against that. And to make the long story short, in order for, like, within our cultural context to, you know, to really honor our parents, we waited for the right time because we never got their blessing. And then as our kids got older and older, what we did in the meantime was we would go as a family, even when the kids were very, very young, every year intentionally on a short-term trip because we knew that would be okay with our parents as long as you came back home. And so we kind of did a, you know, more of a sneaky way to do missions, if you will, in that sense. And then, you know, we got to know a lot of missionaries. We would invite missionaries to our house. So we were very, you know, we tried to be as intentional, as actively engaged as possible, you know, including coming to here. But at some point, we realized our kids are getting older, and we didn't really want to wait any longer because we realized if we waited any longer, then, you know, we wouldn't be able to do it as a family. So we decided to go at the unwise age of 12 and 15, when they're basically teenagers. And what made it easy for us, I think this is where, you know, I think God worked it in a way that was more palatable for us, but also for my parents who were very opposed, in that it came in the way of a paid sabbatical. So it was a one-year commitment. It was, you know, it was salaried. So it made it very easy for me to go for 1 year because I could just say it's 1 year, and we went. And then, of course, as you know, as I'm sure as any of you have done, you know, 1 year is a long time, but 1 year is incredibly short for long-term, you know, medical ministry. You can really accomplish almost nothing. And so I realized that very quickly. But then fortunately, our family as a whole, we're thriving. I mean, our kids love living there. You know, they were both students at Rift Valley Academy. They really, really loved their experience there. And my wife was teaching there, and she was thriving. So we realized, you know, number one, it wasn't like a huge sacrifice on our part because our family was doing quite well. And then we realized 1 year is not enough. And then we even offered our kids the decision to say, you know, we're going to try to make this decision as a family. So what do you think about staying longer? And they're the ones who insisted. They says, if you want to go back, Dad, go ahead. But we're staying. So that 1 year turned into, you know, 6 years in total until the younger of the two graduated from high school there. But it really was a blessed journey. But we had to go through just a lot of difficult years of weighing out, you know, God's will, but also God's timing.
For my wife and I, I'll talk about my wife next because that's the next question. But for myself, we went to Kenya when we were 30 years old. I finished my training, and I ended up being the only physician for 50,000 people in a remote rural area in a clinic. And I realized after a year that wasn't me. That wasn't what God created me for. And it was no point. So we went back, and I had a thriving academic career. And in the early 2000s, let's say 2003 to 2010, I was at the peak of my career with all those academic accolades and chairman of this and president of that. And I realized, even in my role in the church, that for several reasons, three things sort of came together. One was I discovered Tim Keller tapes, and I listened to every Tim Keller sermon at least three or four times because I did it when I did my exercising every week. I did Sonship because I was back, and I was on the board of what was then World Harvest Mission, which you've seen downstairs as Surge. And in that, I realized a couple of things. One, I realized how much, in Keller's terms, I was driven by elder brother righteousness. I wasn't a prodigal, but I defined my identity and my righteousness as a Christian and being good and doing the right things. And what flowed out of me in service was more obligatory than because God had been so good to me and gracious to me. Because the more I discounted God's goodness to me, the less I was loving other people because of how much He loved me. And then I also was realizing as a board member for a mission organization, how much I had already accumulated, like for retirement, other things that the missionaries that were out there were never going to be. So all the people that I was supporting as a board member were never going to have the security that I already had at age 55 or something. So it was sort of a wake up for me. And I realized that there were, in the same context of this, more and more people in the United States who were wanting my job they were creating, we had fellows and fellows and fellows, and they were like all wanting my job. And I realized that there were people out there who, you know, needed me, that, you know, that I could serve. But I also went back to that time in Kenya, and I knew who I was. And I, where I thrived as a person, as a professional, was teaching. So I knew that if I ever went back, my wife and I had a conversation. It had to be in a city. It had to be in a context of medical education. And it couldn't be like just being a service provider. So it really helped us to focus. And I'm going to start the next question, which is, and was my wife on board or was she opposed? And in that same time period, we sent our last child to college. And I said to my wife, so have you thought about we should do something else? And she goes, well, I think that we better redevelop a we before we do anything. You laugh, but, you know, she was a serious question. And that the point was that if we're going to go abroad, we need to go abroad with a common vision of God's call and for what we're going to do. And there had to be a place for both of us, not just me to go somewhere and her to hang along, because that just becomes another ego trip for me and nothing for her. So we spent the next few years looking not just for the place, but the context in which we would both thrive. And not just me. And so when we ultimately went, she ended up teaching English at the university where I ended up, not intentionally, being the dean of medicine. And we also ran a guest house for. Has anybody here heard of the hospital at Kibuye, the team at Kibuye? There's 42 people up there. So we were in the same organization, and we were in the capital, and that's the same medical school. And about 120 nights a year, one or more of them stayed in our house. So that was her, like, primary ministry. And Gilbert, our worker. Your spouse?
Yeah, so I already mentioned my wife. I just got to say, thanks for mentioning the elder brother. We're all prodigals. That's something I came to realize about myself. And my wife, as already mentioned, was the one saying, you know, maybe we should just move instead of more and more of these longer month visits. And for us then, the question became, like for you, where could we go where we could both use our gifts and feel called? That was so important to us. And there are no kids at home anymore. Youngest was at college. And my wife is more gifted than I am in her own sphere. And I gradually came to the realization that I could do my thing just about anywhere, and that the key thing was to find a place where she could teach and use her skills and really plug in. And so we had been many, many times to visit places in Kenya, Cameroon, and Ghana, and I had thought, well, we'll end up in one of those places, but we didn't. We ended up, you know, we spent 3 years looking for a place, and nothing seemed to be quite right, and I was getting really frustrated. And our pastor said, you just got to be patient and pray. And we visited Ethiopia and Addis Ababa, where we now live, and, you know, we got on the plane to come home, and we looked at each other, and we said that this is it. And that unity of calling and purpose to us was really key, because we wouldn't still be there if we didn't have that.
I think it's a great question, because I think it's really important. Our wives, when you're married, you're one, and so you should also be one in this whole call and how you respond to that. My wife, one of the things that my wife and I forgot about as we were considering this is several years before, my wife, we were walking someplace, and she turned to me and just said, you know, I've been following you for years. I followed you through your 120-hour work weeks on the norm. I followed you through training. I followed you to the Philippines. I followed you to, you know, places that she wouldn't have gone on her own. And she just basically says, would there ever be a time in our life when you could follow me? And I wanted to say yes, but my ego, I think, sort of said, well, I'd like to say I would. And we just kept walking. I think we forgot about that for several years. And then when this whole sense of call to mission came, that conversation came back to us. And that sense of, yeah, we need to be willing to follow each other. And it's interesting, when Malawi came up, we We had several doors shut as far as locations for different reasons, visa issues or hospital issues. And so it was just really interesting that when we got a call from Malawi, from the SIM team in Malawi, they were calling because her position was needed on the field. And then she happened to say, oh, but by the way, my husband's an orthopedic surgeon, and he needs a place. And they just happened to say, oh, well, the medical director for the hospital here just told us he was here for dinner last night. He just told us he's leaving. And he hasn't told anybody, so don't tell. So it was just, but it was really interesting that when that call started, it was, I would be following her, which we really just had not even thought about for years. But we so strongly felt that this is a decision you have to make together. When we talked to one of the organizations, when they were talking to us, and they asked us that same question about how are you guys together, and we said, we are having to do this together. This is who we are. And they were shocked. They said probably 50% at least of the people we talked to, they feel like they're having to drag their spouses with them. And we just said, yeah, that is a recipe for disaster on the mission field when you've hit every stress that you can. So you guys who have been there together responding. Both.
Yeah, I guess I want to say two things. One is, I don't know if you guys all remember the animated movie Ice Age, I think. You know, it's the one about the dinosaurs and stuff. There's a line in there that my wife likes to quote all the time. And it's something like, I think the two of the main characters are talking, and they said that you are perfect for each other because she's a lot of fun, and you're no fun at all, and so she completes you. So that pretty much summarizes our marriage. So like in this sense, I mean, my wife is actually quite adventurous, and she's the one who's dragging me out to things where I might just stay home. But she was really, really on board. More importantly, I think she had been with me on some of these trips to other mission hospitals where she didn't have a thing to do, and it was really hard for her, actually, because she's a very social person. She likes to be involved. She likes to contribute. And so because of that experience, when we were planning to return for our sabbatical year, she wanted to make sure that we're going to go to a place where she could have something that she could get, you know, really engaged in, that she could buy into. And then she also wanted to make sure that our kids were going to thrive at the same time, because we realize if one of us is miserable, then it's going to be very challenging for the whole family. So that's why we ended up choosing where we were, because there was a school there she could teach, and then there was all the stuff for the kids. And I think that's part of the reason why we think that our kids really thrive where they did, and they really had a wonderful experience. And even now they're in their mid to late 20s. I think they really look upon that time as being incredibly valuable. The other half of that is just to echo, I think, what Dave was just saying, is that I'm an intensivist primarily, but I'm most trained in pulmonary medicine, so I don't do a lot of outpatient pulmonary medicine. But when I was in Kenya, I had to see some outpatients to help generate some money for the hospital. But believe it or not, my most common type of patient I would see are other missionaries who are coming to me with shortness of breath, and my personal estimate is about 90% of those were actually from miserable spouses who are having more of a emotional issue than it is a biological issue. I mean, they're equally important. I'm not saying one's less important, but they're equally important. But I say that because I think many of them were one of the two people who are thriving in their job. They love their ministry. They love whatever it is that they're doing. But the spouse was actually quite miserable. And yet, I don't know if every couple had that insight. So a lot of what I was dealing medically, at least for the missionary community, was trying to sort out, is it asthma that I need to give some inhaler for, or is it something else? And so I would really emphasize the need to be on the same page.
You can see the list of topics that we hope to touch on there. The next one I'd like to talk to is personal health, because personal health makes a lot of people hesitant to go, especially at midlife or midlife plus. And it's a fear a lot of people have. What if I get sick? What if there's a problem? And I know that we can each talk about where we were and the resources that might have been there. Burundi was without resources. If I had a heart attack or if I had a car accident, goodbye. So that was going to be the way it was. But my wife was basically healthy, but my wife is a genetically Germanic woman raised in California in an age before when baby oil was the answer, not sunscreen. So she had already had melanoma and every kind of skin cancer by the time that we were thinking about going to live at 3,000 feet on the equator. And one of the accommodations that we made for her was coming back every 6 months for a derm check. And ultimately what led to us having to live in the United States was the fact that she'd have to come back every 6 weeks to 2 months because she got more and more skin problems living on the equator at 3,000 feet. And we recovered from her skin graft in Dave's house on one occasion. But health is an issue, and by God's grace, no car accidents or MIs or strokes happened to us while we were there.
Excuse me. Yeah, where I live, there are some medical resources, but there's a lot of things you could die from there that you would live here. And when COVID came, that was clearly an issue. I mean, city of 5 million people, there's about 12 ventilators in total in the and they're not very well used. So we need you, Bert. So that's one thing you just have to, you know, it's this idea on the one hand, be wise, and the other hand, trust God. And how that all works out for you in your individual situation is I can't predict. In the last year in Addis, both my wife and I have required surgery. She had a central retinal detachment, which is a delicate retinal surgery is needed for that. And I, playing basketball on Orthodox Christmas, had a trimyalleolar fracture of my ankle and with dislocation. And in both cases, we came back to the U.S. for the definitive operation. And you know, in some ways we feel guilty that we know so many people there who that's not an option. On the other hand, we're very glad that we have health insurance that covers care in the U.S., and to us that was part of being wise while trusting God.
I think for a lot of people it's a big concern. I was probably kind of naive about it. We say we live, you know, in midlife. You know, we went out in 55, so yeah, that's just about in the middle. Yeah, and so yeah, maybe a little after midlife for a lot of us. One thing I want to touch on is one of the advantages of going to the field as experienced physicians is the comfort and the assurance it actually gives to other missionaries who are on the field to have people who are experienced. Not just out of school, you know, not just out of training, but, you know, to be able to be places, as I would say, there were a lot of people who depended on us for their medical care, other missionaries, other expats, other NGOs. And so it ended up being a helpful thing. And so there's that aspect of healthcare in addition that I think it helps the people around us. And things develop. We were in Malawi, which was probably very similar to where you were, Randy, as far as, you know, things that were available.
Because I've been in Malawi.
Yeah, he was in Malawi and experienced that. My wife developed, you know, she had significant knee arthritis, and while we were there, she had to have two knee replacements. She came back to the States for it. And so, you know, all the agencies, all the groups, you know, most people end up, you know, coming back for significant issues, but for mild, everyday sort of things. One of the things that I think it helps is to actually have other physicians that are there who can let you know, yes, you do need to go back for that, and give you an assurance that it's okay to do that. Because I think there's a sense of guilt sometimes, like, oh, I'm on the field, I shouldn't be going back. But I think that's one of those things, before you go, I think it's great to kind of have this threshold of, yeah, when is it appropriate and when is it not? And then to trust your team to let you know that it's okay to go back. And to build those boundaries around you, so that's not a big shock and surprise when it happens, because it inevitably will happen for most of us.
Yeah, so we didn't have any major health issues ourselves, but we did face issues with my mother, who actually developed gastric cancer. And then so we had to come back and see her. So it's a similar issue where, you know, we had to do that. And, of course, it was a privilege to be able to do that. And then she actually died while we were still on the field. So we were able to come home for the funeral. But those are realities of life, especially if you go later in your life, I think, you know, losing your parents. And then I think, you know, I think I mentioned that we came back when the younger of our two kids was starting college. And our plans were actually to return to a different part of Africa without kids, to a more, you know, to a more of a Muslim-based ministry. But then our daughter actually developed a pretty serious illness, where her she developed a vasculitis that involved her brain and her eye, and so she was, in a pretty difficult situation. So we ended up not going back until this issue is more settled. So that's where, part of the reason why we're still here. But I think, again, you know, being a physician, having contacts of other physicians, you know, really was a tremendous blessing. You know, when we returned from Africa, I took a job at the University of Pittsburgh, and, you know, and they had some outstanding physicians who came to our, you know, to our side, and there were people praying for us even, you know, within the secular community there. There were individuals who came out to really help us. So I think it's, you know, it is really nice to be able to have those kind of resources.
And I think that we'll touch on it at the end, I suppose, about sending agencies, but one of the thing in choosing the sending agency is to make sure that that needs like this that may not be needs for young people in their 20s who are single are ready to be accommodated. My sending agency, and also because at a different phase of life, your cost may be less and your salary may be less, and you can negotiate for more frequent visits that you might need because of your health and your age and your parents, and we'll touch on parents in a minute, but I wanted to give Dave particularly a chance to talk about leaving, and Mark may have something to say about that. Because, I mean, I gave my workplace 2.5 years notice, but I was an employee, and I had this in a large group, and I just sort of faded out of academia, but you had people who loved you.
Three, yeah. I think leaving was hard. You know, I've been in private practice in a relatively small community, and so it's one of those things which irritated my kids to no end. If I went to the grocery store, you know, I'd have four clinical visits, you know, in the aisle for cereal, and so it irritated my kids to no end that, you know, that I could not go anywhere and not have a patient, you know, come up to me for some reason. Of course, I would forget their name But I think leaving was hard, and one of the things that was difficult is that I remember when I talked about leaving, several people actually got very mad and just saying, "There's such a need here, and you're providing such a service here. Why would you leave?" And it was interesting because we used I said, "Well, would it help if I gave a talk to all the nurses and all the groups?" So I talked to several groups in the hospital, and the thing that made the biggest difference is when I told them I gave them a sense, this is our need here. This is how many orthopedic surgeons are in this community. And then I gave the need of how many orthopedic surgeons there were per capita in Malawi. And there was a thing called World Mapper that showed that very pictorially and very graphically. And I remember there was one nurse who was just rabidly against us leaving. She was angry. I showed that thing. 180-degree switch. She became our biggest cheerleader for going and for, you know, and she became just a really big advocate for us leaving. And I just think leaving well, you know, I think I already mentioned leaving out of a place of happiness and being, you know, really happy where you are and this sense of contentment. But I think that, you know, I think it's really important to leave well, and I think that also goes to the point of, you know, you are a missionary where you are now. So, you know, you're not going to become a missionary when you're not going to become somebody who proclaims Christ well in your work overseas if you're not doing it where you are now. And I'm not saying that to build guilt, just I think it's just something to analyze and think about. Is this something, what baggage am I carrying with me? And so I think having that time, for Andy having 2.5 years, I had 2 years to really sit there and think, where do I need to work on? And you guys have mentioned sonship a couple times. I frankly could not endorse a preparation for going to the field more than sonship. There are a lot of things you can do. Bible school is great. There are a lot of wonderful things. But I think this, you know, the sonship as a program is a pretty intensive program. But it, I think there's no better preparation, in my opinion.
All that about leaving, that you don't want to waste that opportunity with people, because people wonder, why are you going? And I worked in a large healthcare institution and in a large division of GI, and a lot of my colleagues and the nurses and aides I worked with, there were some of them just completely mystified. Why would you do that? And it's a marvelous opportunity to tell people why you're going. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, when you get to where you're going, the commonest question is, why are you here? So having good answers to those questions is an important thing.
Did you have anything specifically?
Yeah, just one quick thing I want to add is, you know, when we left to stay long-term in Kenya, actually our decision was to mainly finish out our career there. But then, you know, I think God intervened. But we, you know, with the death of my mother, who left now a aging widower, and then also our daughter got sick, so that our plans changed. And so where I think that becomes relevant is that even though our plan was to stay in Africa, you know, for the rest of our career, when these things happen, it was important for me to be able to come back to the States and actually have a job again. And so I think if I hadn't, you know, left well, the prospects would be a lot more difficult. And I think especially if you leave like an academic field, you know, like being gone for 6 years is pretty much over, I think. But I was fortunate enough to find something, and I think part of it was because you know we were very conscientious about leaving well.
One of the other things, as far as leaving well, one of the things I would make sure that you do is really keep your contacts, keep your associations, keep your friendships, keep your affiliations with academic institutions if you've been there. Keep a good relationship with a practice or other practices that you have affiliations or, you know, friendships with, because I think it's really valuable to maintain those when you're on the field. And then when you come back, it's very difficult to enter back into practice if you haven't been able to step back into practice in some way on your home assignments at different times. And I frankly went out and I never thought about that. So when I came back after our 6 years, it would have been a more, I chose not to go back into practice for other reasons, but if I had wanted to, it would have been quite difficult. And most of my colleagues who are from the UK, they found it extremely difficult to step back into a clinical role. And so a lot of people now before they leave, are making sure that they have relationships, and that's been really valuable to them when they come back.
And I'll add that it was this guy, Dave, who advised me to do that. And my wife and I are back in Minnesota every summer for 6 weeks, and I work every summer in Minnesota for part of that time, and for the reasons he gave. And it turns out to be very helpful in my job teaching in academic institutions in Ethiopia that is true of me. So.
Burton also already mentioned about his parents not being excited about his going, and his mother's death. And aging parents are a real factor for a lot of people who consider whether they should go. And we talk about a lot of barriers here, but it's not like if I was younger or I had a young family, it would be different. You've talked about your daughter's illness, and it was your daughter, and that would have been if we had started earlier. But parents are a real issue. My parents were not excited about my wife and I going. Her parents were dead, so they didn't care. But my parents were like, you're abandoning us in our time of need. Your siblings will never care for us. Only you are, you know. So you understand. And there was truth to that. And so unlike Burton, my culture was like, well, we're going anyway. they were doing okay, but literally about 2 years after our leaving, my stepfather died and my mother's dementia was significant without his support. So we had to examine, could we be gone? What would work? So we moved her to another city where our son was living with his wife, and we were able to return. She was in assisted living while we were gone. But again, because of our relationship with our sending organization, we came back twice a year. So the dermatology visits included visits to my mother and to our children to enable us to be in that part of life. Which brings up the other question is, will my still forming adult children be okay without me? And that was certainly, Burton brought his with him. But Mark, are you doing okay with that?
Yeah, so as I said, our children were all out of the home, youngest in college when we went. And we went with SIM, which requires a very thorough psychological evaluation of candidates. And we went through that whole long thing. We filled out the Minnesota Multiphasic Index, and we had all sorts of other interviews separately and together. One of them, my wife came running out of it shouting, "He says I'm normal!" But the shock to me of that psychological whole thing was in our final meeting with the psychologist, he said to us, "You realize by moving, you're giving up influence in your daughter's lives." And that just like hit me like a ton of bricks, because I hadn't thought about that. And so, yeah, I think that's a real issue. For us, we said, well, we got to do something proactive about that. So it meant that we do weekly Zooms on Sundays with our kids, and they're great kids, and they connect with us. That when we'd been in Addis for a little less than 6 months, they all came at Christmas for a week to see where our mom and dad, and it was actually okay there. And it was just like a month before COVID hit, so they haven't been back since. But that turned out, I think, to be important. And we need to see them at least once a year, and twice a year is better. And so part of being back in the U.S. for 6 weeks every summer is to spend time with them. And if we can arrange to meet one of them in Europe on a school break time or something, we do that because, you know, they're figuring out important stuff in life, like who's my spouse going to be, maybe, and is this job really right for me? And Zoom doesn't always cut it. So we did not want going overseas to somehow mean that we divorced ourselves from them. Oh, sorry.
I think having your kids involved is really important. Whether they're adult kids or kids you take with you, I think their involvement is really critical. For both my daughters were married, moved away. One was here in the States. One was living in the Czech Republic, where she had married a guy that she'd met on a mission field. And so it was really important. It actually surprised us how much our kids, both of our kids, said, "Well, where is home?" We were kind of shocked. We were like, "Well, home is where you and your husband are," but they still had this sense of our home being their home. And so we did have to work through that with them. And so one thing that really helped for us is we highly involved them in that discussion and why we were going to the mission field. We really, for us, it was really important to have their approval for that we weren't going despite their disagreement, you know, despite their what they felt. And then we thought it was really important for them to experience where we were as soon as they could. So as soon as the mission would let us, they wanted us to get used to the culture and the environment. So we ended up having them come as soon as they could, and thank goodness that was over a Christmas holiday for everybody. We had a wonderful visit. And for them, they said that made the biggest difference between understanding why we went, because I also let them come into the hospital with us and make rounds and this sort of thing. And that was just very, very valuable. On the backside of that, and my in-laws, my folks had passed away. My in-laws were still alive. They had been missionaries, so it was an easy, you know, they were so excited when we decided to go on the mission field. My mother-in-law especially, she thought she had gone to heaven, you know, when her daughter was going to be a missionary. But one of the big reasons we came home was because my brother-in-law, who had been taking care of them, said, we can't do it anymore. They were going downhill. They needed us at the exact same time we were having grandchildren. And our kids were saying, we love what you've been doing, but we also think it's time for you to come home. And so it was good to go with their support. We felt it was good for our relationship with them that when they said it's time to come home, that it also corresponded for some other events that made us need to come home.
I'm just, I want to leave at least 10 minutes for questions, so we're going to rush through the next sort of questions. But grandparents, we touched on, I don't think any of us were grandparents while we were on doing active mission work. But one of the issues for all of us, at least especially me, was an experience in Africa. And now I'd gone when I was 30, and it'd been me and 50,000 people, and I delivered 200 babies, and I'm a pediatrician. So, I mean, I did it all, but I didn't necessarily do it well. And I was talking about going to teach. And in my case, God answered my fears in a way that I didn't want him to do it. I started a program for Cincinnati Children's in Malawi, which is what Dave was referring to, where there were two pediatricians and 400 inpatient children and 400 children presenting as outpatients with 60 admissions a day. And so I had an intensive 7 months of education in tropical medicine that I never expected to get. And because about 60% of the patients we admitted have malaria, I became really good with every complication of malaria that you can imagine. So by the time I arrived at this medical school where I had to have some credibility in Africa as a dean, God had given me some credibility because I could answer most questions about a lot of things that when I left the United States I didn't know anything about.
Yeah, I think the answer for me is you go as a learner. You're not there as like the expert to dispense knowledge to the needy colleagues around you. No, you're there to learn from them about how it works here and what the diseases are and what the diagnostic methods and treatments are. And, you know, that's been true for me in every mission experience, short-term but also long-term. And, you know, my first year going to Black Lion Hospital in Addis to the GI clinic, room about this, half this size, with 8 desks around the periphery, and a resident or fellow at each one. We were only seeing 80 patients an afternoon, but you know, I would just be rotating around, and I'd be learning from every case, like, what tests do we have? What treatment can we give this patient? Oh, we're back in the 1970s. Okay, so, you know, and what diseases are common? Oh, this chronic terminal ileitis is just as likely to be TB as Crohn's disease here. Well, that's interesting. What do we do about that? So you go as a learner, no matter how much you know and how competent you are in your current setting. And that makes a lot of that better, I think, if everyone knows that about you there.
Yeah, I think almost the more expert you are in what you're doing, the more you need to go and with the idea that you're going to learn from them. One of the folks on my team with SIM, I love their saying, as they say, are we going with our degree in our hand in front of us, or are we going with a towel over our arm to serve them as we wash their feet? And I think going with that attitude, that we're going to serve them, we're going to learn from them, we're going to honor them, rather than being the ugly American who just is going in there, you know, trying to convince them how smart we are and how they need to change to fit our model. So I think, you know, just that is always really stuck in my head as a visual image, is are you going with your degree in hand or your towel over your arm? So.
Yeah, so we were at Kajabi Hospital, so it's not really a tropical place, but obviously it's a resource variable place compared to the U.S., and so there's a lot of learning that we all had to do. And I'm going to touch upon this actually tomorrow morning at a different talk, but like one thing that was abundantly clear is you may know the entire literature for your particular field, but it doesn't necessarily apply to this new context. So I can think for years, you know, we were quite I think, arrogant in the West about how we resuscitate people with in septic shock, for example, and we would advocate for certain things, and if you didn't do it, you're a bad doctor. If you didn't do it, you're a bad hospital. And then many people in the West would criticize people from Africa, saying, oh, you poor people, you can't do the things that we can do. You know, that was essentially the message. Until, of course, you know, we start to do studies in Africa to show that in some cases it may actually increase mortality if we did that. And then I think subsequent studies in the West have validated that. So I think it really have to be humble that first of all, you know, like the evidence that we think we know may be fallible, number one, but also even if it's true in the U.S., it's not necessarily applicable in a different context. So I think we all have to approach it with some humility.
I'm going to take the question on language and give you to the question on raising support. But language, I went to a francophone country, which means I had to spend a year investing in French. And at 58, the question was, is it really worth it? Should I do that? Is that a waste of time? And I'll go back and say it was a tremendous thing to do. Not only was it fun to live in France, but it made the difference for my communication to my students and my credibility in a country that, and most of you know, that Francophone Africa is neglected compared to Anglophone Africa. So that it was a tremendous chance to move the needle in a place where there were almost no chance of using English, and still isn't. But I can go back again and again, and I was there just for the last 2 weeks till last Sunday, being able to step in and engage my students and do bedside teaching because of that French. So my French is not good. And my students are really gracious because I gave lots of lectures in French and it's not that good, but it got by, and praise God. So Dave and Mark, I want you guys to talk about why one would raise support, and if you had fears approaching people that you knew and asking them for money.
Yeah, so we only have 10 minutes left. You sure you want us to talk about this?
Because we're going to talk about...
So I would say that that's the last thing I wanted to do, and it was absolutely necessary. And essentially the reason we're still... One of the reasons we're still there is because we raise support. Not so much about the money, but about the support team. When you go long-term, culture shock takes a long time, and it sets very deeply, and you get to the six-month mark, and all the stuff that was exciting and new when you arrived, you're starting to hate it, and you don't see anything good about this place, and you look out the window and say, why don't we just go home? And the part of the answer is because there's a team of people that believe in us enough to actually have skin in the game, and they sent us here, and they're communicating with us, and we're just going to keep at it. And it also helps with the self-identity thing. You know, a lot of you know yourselves as people who support missionaries and who are financially independent, and it's good for us to find out that we actually need to depend on others. So our agency would not have permitted us to serve without raising support, and that was the right thing.
Yeah, we're the same agency.
And it's the same, I heard.
But I think the key about not being independent, you know, we as Americans tend to think we're independent, we can do things on our own, and we were told, no, you can't go because you need to be dependent. And I tend not to spiritualize a lot of things, but I know when I was there were at the really hard times, it always really helped to know that we had this team of people that were praying for us. And I don't think I had really felt that or sensed that in my life and practice, that no people were praying, but there is a palpable knowledge and understanding, and just a comfort in knowing that people were lifting us up to the Lord. I had folks in our recovery room. One of the neatest gifts they gave me. So I usually tear up when I say this, but this whole group of nurses set up on a calendar in the recovery room. And they basically said, we've all assigned days. So each of these days, these are the days we're praying for you. And to know that had that sort of support was tremendous. And I'd never really experienced that before then. So, and that was all around support raising. So.
I would just add that, I think for us, I mentioned that there are some additional cultural dimensions, but one of the cultural dimensions is that in our culture, it's actually shameful to ask for money. Mm-hmm. And so it was an additional barrier for us. But it ended up being a tremendous blessing. I mean, one was a story of when we were actually like speaking at churches, trying to raise funds for our ministry. I mean, there were many miraculous stories, but one story is this young man came up and said, you know, my father has been collecting money in a shoebox for 10 years, and he knows he's supposed to give it to somebody who is going to Africa. And then when we came and spoke, he brought us the shoebox. It's literally just, you know, not organized in any way, like, you know, there's all kinds of stuff in there. And it was over $3,000 that this man has been saving up. And we know that was from God to encourage us, you know. And then we went into churches that actually wanted to be faithful and give, but they actually said that, you know, we don't know any missionaries that would, you know, that we could support. And it turned out they had a church surplus, I'm not kidding, of over $1 million for missions that they didn't know what to do with it. And they were asking us, do you know anybody who could do that? So it goes both ways.
Where do we sign up?
Yeah, I mean, it was encouraging for us to be there. It really energized us. It really confirmed our call. But also, I think there are many people who want to give, but might not even know where to give. And so it's a blessing for them as well.
Don't be afraid to ask your patients. Talk to your patients about what you're going to do. I wasn't going to do that. Frankly, I thought it was ridiculous how much money you've spent to be my patients. And so how can I ask you for more money? And somebody told us, said, you know, somebody's going to get angry that you're not asking them for support. And we said, yeah, right. You know, but I actually had two patients like the week after I heard that who came in and they said, you're going to Malawi, I heard, you're going on missions. I said, why have you not asked us? Why have you not told us? And these two patients were angry at me for not talking to them. And so I encourage you to talk to your patients.
I'll take the last question myself to make it brief. About sending agencies, and we all had sending agencies we liked, and I love mine, and I would encourage, if that's a question for you, to choose a sending agency that has a lot of experience in the way, in the place that you're going, that has a great reputation for member care, that has flexibility to let you do the things that are necessary for your stage of life, and one that has experience in crisis. I did not expect when I went that I would have a crisis, but there was attempted coup d'etat and weeks of fighting in the country I was in, the city I was in. And, you know, I jokingly had created a contingency plan policy thing because it was required for our team. And sure enough, I had to use it. And we were on red for a long time in our area. So, take sending agencies seriously and make sure that you have one that can do both the financial part, the member care part, and the crisis part. So I'm going to leave it and let you all ask us questions if it's helpful. Because we want you to be out there replacing us and serving as the Lord calls you. Question.
Possibility of going not with U.S. sending agency, but with an academic setting in the host country. Number of those items that you just listed off would not at all be present. You know, if I take the teaching job, I got to teach those courses anyway. But yet, it seems like the possible advantages of experienced old white guy working under my colleagues in Uganda just also would be just really appealing to me.
So, I had a sending agency with all the advantages I talked about, but on the ground, I worked for a Burundian rector of a university that was Burundian started, Burundian run. So my boss was Burundian. I didn't get the resources I would get from doing my job that I would get if I was American. It was all Burundian. So in that sense, I had the best of both worlds. I was the only white guy on campus. And upcountry, we had a team of like what's now 11 American specialists at the hospital that I sent my students to at the time. So, but when the crisis hit, sure, my partners, our partners on the ground would take care of me if I was arrested or had a crash with my car or something like that. And I was responsible for teaching the classes to them. But the other part of the big picture that was rescuing my life and the other negotiations were there as well.
Do you have other comments?
Yeah, you know, there's a whole model of doing really second career medical missions that involves taking a paid post overseas. And often it's in a place that a missionary can't go. I mean, you know, it's you're getting paid to teach or work in the Gulf, in an Arab country, or in one of the stands. And there's other places around the world, too. And I think it's a very valid model. The people I know who've done that, the big challenge is community. And not being part of a team of people that's there from a sending agency that has experience and depth. And maybe not even having a support team back home, unless you've been very intentional about raising a prayer team and a team that's going to provide some funds for ministry efforts wherever you are. So, but it's an important model, and for some people, I think it's the right model.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's some opportunities in some very closed access countries that we could not go in, you know, with our agencies, you know, with the explicit support. But yeah, there are many, many opportunities in a lot of the closed access countries in North Africa, the Middle East, and as you were mentioning, and really wonderful roles. So I think it's some very new things. And so yeah, I would encourage you if the Lord's calling you to that, to really explore that with some of the agencies.
And there's a group called Scatter Global that would be really leaders in that area and can provide some community and support in a quiet way, which I think is mm-hmm. important.
Yeah.
Other questions? We just touched on everything. Yeah, Jim.
Well, I would just make one comment with the gentleman just asked here. I took early retirement, but I went to a really nice place. I went to the University of Singapore. So I got paid a pretty good salary, but it was a wonderful way for me to retire, and I ended up 20 years being involved there with various people. I mean, it wasn't as a ministry, but if you're thinking of doing something like that, it can be really worthwhile.
I love what you said, except I disagree with one thing. It was a ministry. Just like you're a minister, it's a ministry where you're serving now, wherever you're working, so I'm sure it was a ministry there.
Surely you have some stories about yourself. You're here for a reason. Maybe we're out of time, but.
Okay, I would like to say that this was a terrific, terrific workshop. Everything you said, I agree with every single thing. And I would like to say, so my husband and I were 8 years in Cameroon, came back for 13 years while our kids were getting through high school, and it took a while to kind of grow up. And after 13 years, we went back, which we always planned to do, but it just took a while. But going back, after teaching at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, for 13 years, he found that, in both of us, the respect we had was like quadruple when we left, what we left. Mm-hmm. That now you're older, you're a professor, they have huge respect, and you know, in other countries, it's not like here where if you're young you get attention. There, if you're older, you get attention. So what you say means so much more.
It's true.
And you have all that experience, so you know a lot more. So you're really worth a lot. In the best sense.
Yeah, over here.
So let's say you are now charged with mobilizing this segment of the Christian physician population into this desire for second careers or midlife or whatever. What are you going to do to mobilize missionaries at that stage of life?
To me, it's mainly about identity, the thing I started off talking about. And, you know, there are diagnostic signs of not having identity rooted in Christ. And if your identity isn't rooted in Christ, you're never going to do this long term. It's just not going to happen. And, you know, if you care a lot about what other people think of you, if you easily get angry when things don't go your way, if you're kind of tired of hearing this gospel thing, I've heard it 1,000 times and I believe it, but come on, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. Those are all signs that I personally have experienced that my identity was not primarily being a child of God. And that may sound like an overly spiritual answer to you, but if that to me is like a precondition to be able to do this and to be, you know, fruitful. That doesn't mean all those folks who are on fire for Jesus are going to go overseas. No, the Lord may have many different things for them, but it's, to me, a necessary starting place.
I think one thing that can be valuable is how do you, number one, how do we get the message out? But I think there's that sense of what we're going to is going to be the sacrifice. We're going to be going to something that's hard, that's going to be difficult, that this is going to be the biggest challenge of your life. And in some ways it is. But to give them that sense that the reward of it, I mean, I loved, and this sounds Pollyannish, I loved every day that I practiced. I mean, I had great partners, I had a great hospital, I had great colleagues. But my most rewarding time in service has been once we left practice and we went to Malawi and we served overseas. Got to know the most interesting, the most fascinating people. It took a few years before we felt comfortable with that. But when we left, we just realized this is the best life we have lived. Not because of our financial circumstances or how nice a car we drove or how nice a home we lived in, but it was the most rewarding part of our entire career. So, and I think to be able to give that, because I don't think people have a hard time seeing that. They see this, oh, you're going to do something difficult. And doesn't mean it's easy, but it is the most rewarding time of your career.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, God's going to change the hearts. And one of the reasons we had this panel and suggested it was to be able to open up the dialogue, to give models and to show that God can work through all the things that people are afraid are going to keep them from the field, to show that a variety of different people can leave their career and do things that because God's going before them, even though it's not an easy answer. And I'll agree with Dave. I will say that, you know, I had 28, 30 some years of career in U.S. medicine, and I probably saved lots of people in pediatric emergency department, and I educated, you know, scores of residents and fellows. But I went to a country that, when I went there, had 300 physicians for 12 million people, and our medical school alone graduated another 319 so far. And the impact of those people that they spread out through that country has changed the healthcare of an entire nation in a way that that the impact, that's, you know, if I was going to go into that cliche thing, what I want on my tombstone, is that's the kind of thing that made a bigger difference with my life than all the career that I had before, is those 319 students who I correspond with all the time. All right, I'll call time because it's late, but thanks.